I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Welcome to The Takeaway. In late 2019, as Americans geared up for the winter holiday season, we began to see news stories about a contagious virus affecting people in China. By early 2020, we were getting regular reports about illness in Italy, Spain, England. Most of us at that point were aware something was happening, but it was happening, you know, over there. Nearly 2 years later, Americans are battling a surge of misinformation that is stoking vaccine hesitancy and making it all too easy to lose sight of the truly global nature of the continuing pandemic. But even a casual glance at the map tracking global vaccinations reveals an obvious pattern. Rich countries are vaccinated, poor nations are not. The UAE is slaying the vaccine game with 92% of residents having at least one dose. The G7 nations, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the UK, they're putting up big numbers at 70 to 75% vaccination rates. And even the US, with all of our maddening anti-vax rhetoric, is holding strong at more than 60% of Americans having at least one shot. The story is tragically different in Uzbekistan. 9% full vaccination. Vietnam, 5% full vaccination. Syria, 1%. Uganda, Sudan, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Ethiopia. Less than 1% of the population is fully vaccinated in each of these African nations. And last month, the vast global inequality led the World Health Organization's Director General to call for a temporary halt on booster shots, as he expressed his frustration with the slow pace of vaccine donations from high-income countries.
We have been calling for vaccine equity from the beginning, not after the richest countries have been taken care of. Low and lower middle-income countries are not the second or third priority. Their health workers, older people, and other at-risk groups have the same right to be protected. I will not stay silent when the companies and countries that control the global supply of vaccines think the world's poor should be satisfied with leftovers.
So allow me to translate that into a colloquialism used by generations of frustrated parents. No, you cannot have a booster shot for dessert when you've only eaten half the vegetables of protective vaccination. And I'm going to take this leftover vaccine and send it to poor nations who will be grateful for it. Now go to bed. With me now is Apoorva Mandavilli, who is science reporter at the New York Times. Glad to have you back on the show, Apoorva.
It's nice to be here.
And Lawrence Gustin, who is professor of global health law at Georgetown University, director of the World Health Organization Center on National and Global Health Law, and author of the forthcoming book, Global Health Security, A Blueprint for the Future. Thanks for joining us, Lawrence.
Thank you. You've made me smile with my bedtime story and not eating my vegetables.
So actually, let me start there, because by the time you're 10 years old, Lawrence, you look back at your mom, you're like, you're not sending my leftovers to another country. That's not happening. That's not practical, lady. So at what point, or should we be thinking that same way about vaccines? Are booster shots actually sort of the nature of the problem relative to this overall global inequity?
Yeah, you know, they contribute to the problem, but they're not really the cause of the problem. But it sounds like the United States and other countries, the UK just decided to do it yesterday, is just completely tone deaf to the suffering in the rest of the world and entirely oblivious to WHO's call for a moratorium on boosters. And so, yeah, doses are not fungible. It's, you know, it's really hard to get them off the shelves on our, you know, pharmacies, you know, to say Ethiopia. A lot of regulations, expiration, whole range of things. But it just sounds immoral. And in some ways it is, although I do know from the White House that President Biden's under enormous political pressure to push it forward in the U.S.
The boosters, you mean?
The boosters, indeed, yes.
So, Apoorv, I guess I'm interested in, again, just if we're going to build off Lawrence's point there, that there's, this pressure for booster shots at a time when we have vaccine hesitancy, why we don't have that same kind of massive political pressure to ensure that much of the rest of the world has at least an opportunity to be vaccinated.
Well, low-income countries are notoriously bad at exerting political pressure on high-income countries. The WHO has been advocating on the behalf of these countries, but the high-income countries have to listen. There are multiple problems why those countries have not had those doses. I want to give you one number in addition to the one that you mentioned. Only 0.4% of the total doses so far have been given to low-income countries of all of the doses in the world. And that just tells us how little has made it to those countries. Part of the reason for that is distribution problems. You know, we've had trouble actually getting the doses from airport tarmacs to shots in arms. There are issues with how to get those doses into the people. But there are also issues with high-income countries like the U.S. and some other countries actually having export bans on the things needed to make vaccines for other places. There are enormous production problems. You know, J&J was supposed to make 1 billion doses this year, and they've made about a tenth of that. So there are multiple problems causing this very low uptake in low-income countries. And countries like the U.S. and the U.K. and other, rich countries have an obligation to listen and to help, because apart from the moral and ethical reasons, we also have a very good scientific reason to make sure that everyone is vaccinated, which is to prevent the virus from evolving.
So Apoorv, just stick with this for 1 second, because you said something that is a detail I don't know and I want to understand a little more. What do you mean by having export, that we have rules against exports for some of the things necessary to make vaccines? What kinds of items?
That could be lipids, which are these the packaging materials for the vaccines. They could be tubes, needles, syringes, and they're made in a few different places. And the U.S. and Japan and some other countries are restricting how many of those raw materials can be shipped out of their own countries. And so that automatically puts a limit on how many vaccines you can make worldwide.
Got it. Thank you. So, Lawrence, can you talk to us about COVAX? I can remember at the G7 meeting, President Biden sort of, came out, he talked about COVAX. He was like, don't worry, we got this under control. But now, all these months later, we're still talking about 0.4% of vaccines going to poor nations. What's going on with COVAX?
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. Could I just add to a couple of the points that Apoorv made? And I thought she did it beautifully. I mean, it's not strictly export bans, but kind of use of the Defense Production Act that prioritized things here and made it so that we had to keep all of those raw materials here in the United States. But the big problem we haven't actually even mentioned was that, while the public was just kind of going about their daily life and they didn't realize it, very early in the pandemic, even before we had vaccines, rich countries and indeed rich businesses at Davos had already started to plan and then pre-purchase most of the world's supplies. And so countries in the European Union, the UK, the US, Canada, really pre-purchased most of the supplies even before they were authorized or manufactured. And that does two things. One, it leaves us with great global scarcity. And second, it shows that some of the direct responsibility for why we've got these global inequities is because of the decisions that we made to prioritize ourselves. COVAX.
While Americans in their households were stockpiling paper towels and toilet tissue, the nation was stockpiling these necessary aspects for making and then distributing the vaccines.
Yeah, and actually the vaccine doses themselves, they were already bought up even before we even thought about authorizing them, even before they finished clinical trials.
Got it. And in fact, I can even imagine listeners saying, well, yeah, I mean, that's precisely what we want our government to do, is to, protect us and, to build the hedge here nationally first. But obviously, again, on this kind of scientific point about how something like a contagious respiratory pandemic moves Apoorva, it's also an insufficient strategy, even for the protection of Americans over time, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, this is where the boosters come in, too. If we start thinking about just hoarding doses, you know, we're talking now about the next round of doses and the next round of doses. And where does that leave the rest of the world? And where does that leave the unvaccinated people right here in the United States? I mean, that really should be the main focus everywhere. According to every expert I've spoken with, that will give us better benefit than trying to get boosters out to the rest of the country. But, you know, from the perspective of the companies, you can see why they would continue to fulfill these orders. I mean, the US is paying about $7 per donated dose, and that's a third of what we pay when we buy for Americans. So if you're Pfizer, you know where you're going to make more money. And so the companies also continue to fulfill those orders over what the low-income countries need or what COVAX might need.
Oh, and now you've reminded me. Lawrence, let's circle back. I'd asked you initially about COVAX. Can you tell us a little bit about where it stands?
So, you know, very early on in the pandemic, Tedros, the head of the World Health Organization, and partners like the Gavi Alliance for Vaccinations, CEPI, and others got together and they formed what's called the ACT Accelerator. It was a global initiative to try to do two things: to amplify or accelerate the supplies of scarce medical resources, not just vaccines, but also other medical resources like therapeutics and diagnostics. And at the same time, to find a mechanism, a multilateral mechanism for the equitable global distribution of these. Unfortunately, you know, COVAX was a great idea, and I couldn't imagine a world without COVAX, but it hasn't even begun to achieve either of its objectives, either to boost supplies of these medical resources that are life-saving, or to make sure that low and middle-income countries get the doses that they need. You know, right now, even health workers who are right on the front lines with bulging hospital admissions around the world aren't vaccinated for the most part. And, you know, that is a moral stain on the nation. In fact, I think it could be one of the greatest, you know, ethical failures of our generation.
Apoorva, maybe you can sort of paint a picture for us about what this lack of vaccination around the rest of the world means relative to lived experience. So, you know, I can easily look at the map. I can see where there are, you know, fewer than 1% of individuals being vaccinated. Do we also see higher cases there? What are the mortality rates like? Just talk to me about what it means to not have vaccine.
What it means to not have vaccines is where we were last spring, where every case meant people would end up in the hospital and the medical system is completely overwhelmed. You know, I think we saw these enormous numbers back in the winter in December and January here. And a lot of that has gone down really because of vaccination. I mean, we're still seeing record cases here in some states and hospitalizations and deaths, but this would be so much worse with the Delta variant if we didn't have vaccines. And so that's what those countries are facing. Some of these countries like India and African countries and in South America are enjoying a little bit of a reprieve right now. The cases are actually falling after many months of high numbers, but those numbers will come back up. A lot of those countries are facing fourth waves, and the Delta variant is no joke, as we know. So, you know, it's really terrifying for people in those countries to be waiting basically for this variant to take over and send them to the hospital. And people are dying again in really high numbers in a lot of these places. So, as I mentioned before, every single person who is infected anywhere in the world is an opportunity for the virus to evolve. So this is really in all of our best interests to make sure that people are vaccinated there.
Lawrence, as I listened to Apoorva talk about that that human cost, and before the break, you were talking about the moral and ethical stain that this will be both in this moment and then how history will remember this. And yet I wonder, is there anything else, any other set of institutions, practices, people who are able to hold accountable these wealthy nations beyond history and our moral judgments?
Yeah, it's a really great question. You know, in international relations and international law, countries really have been very assertive about their autonomy and their sovereignty, and some even boast about it, you know, my country first, and which often means my country only. And as Apoorva said, you know, that's not a very good strategy for get us out of this, because if you've got widely circulating virus, it's very much in our national security interests to do something about it. We do have international law, you know, the international health regulations. The World Health Organization this November is going to be holding a special session on a pandemic treaty to try to deal with these questions, with equity being the first one. But international law and treaties are hard, as we know. We've seen it with the Iran nuclear deal and in climate change and in so many other areas. So it's hard, but there are solutions. And AIDS maybe gives us the best model, because, you know, Apoorva was talking about, you know, we've got this vaccine, it's helping us, they're dying because they don't have it. That reminds me very much of the beginnings of the AIDS pandemic, where civil society, you know, ACT UP and others in the United States, the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa said, you know, there's this pill that, you know, is just saves your life. The rich have it, the poor don't. And that had a lot of traction. And I think that might start to have traction now, as has been reported. And I've talked to the White House. I think that invitations to the a global vaccine summit that Biden sent out to the in advance of the UN General Assembly has gone out, and I think there's going to be announced over the next coming weeks some significant plans to try to vaccinate the world. My understanding is something like the goal being 70% of the world being vaccinated by the fall of next year.
Apoorva, can you talk to me a little bit about the infrastructure issues in poorer nations? So if tomorrow there were this ability and willingness to sort of make more vaccine doses available on large scale, what might be some of the challenges in poorer nations relative to infrastructure in getting them, again, from tarmac to people's arms? And what other kinds of maybe longer term investments do rich nations need to make in order to make the mass vaccinations possible?
These are very simple problems in some cases. These countries are actually short of funds just in terms of training people to you know, to administer the shots, to persuade people to get them to do the sort of outreach campaigns that we've had to do. And then simple things like buying fuel to transport the doses to clinics. A lot of this can be alleviated by funding. I mean, we know that the US has made some commitments to get hundreds of millions of doses to other countries, but that commitment has come at the cost of diverting funds away from the money that was supposed to go to help these countries get the shots into arms. So it's sort of, you know, we look like we're doing something very good, but we're doing it at the cost of something else that is also required. I think one of the big things that really needs to happen is, as Lawrence was talking about, is for these countries to get together and figure out what is needed and to make a commitment together to get all of the things that these countries need. And that's not just vaccines, but also, you know, testing and other things, oxygen, other supplies that they need. And that will help a lot in containing the epidemic. And COVAX, which we were talking about before, you know, they're about 500 million doses short of where they wanted to be at the end of this year. And a lot of that is actually not from a high-income country. That's from India, which was supposed to make about 1 billion doses for the rest of the world at low cost. You know, Larry was talking about the AIDS drugs, and those drugs were made at low cost by companies in India and South Africa and other places. And India was supposed to do that for this pandemic as well, making doses of AstraZeneca. But they were hit by such a big outbreak in the spring that they stopped exporting them and kept them for themselves. And so that if India starts to export doses, that will also help a lot.
Yeah, as you tell that story, though, it's pretty clear what that cycle may end up being relative to the challenge of trying to make the doses to stop it, but also the way that the virus keeps changing and then moving through our global communities. Apoorva Mandavelli, science reporter at the New York Times, Lawrence Gostin, professor of global health law at Georgetown University and director of the World Health Organization Center on National and Global Health Law. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Melissa.
Now, last month, a group of 13 aid organizations working in the Mideast released a devastating and urgent report. According to the report, more than 12 million people in Syria and Iraq are in immediate danger of losing access to water, food, and electricity.
They say rising temperatures, record low levels of rainfall, and drought are depriving people of drinking and agricultural water.
That was Indus TV discussing that new report, which calls on the international community to address the drought and the regional catastrophe that is likely to follow. Joining me to discuss this is Nirvana Shalki, the Middle East and North Africa Regional Director for CARE. Nirvana, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Melissa, for having me.
So why did CARE and these 12 other organizations feel that now was the right time to release this report?
We work with vulnerable populations across the world, and of course, the Middle East and North Africa is no exception. We have been monitoring with great concern the worsening drought in the region. We had to increase programming to support people's livelihoods and food security. And since the climate and subsequent drought are hugely disruptive to agriculture and harvest, and adding to that the COVID pandemic as well, the water crises people are facing in the region now is really coming to unprecedented level, such as in Iraq and Syria. It is actually coming on top of existing crises and reaching a point where the already preventative measures that we are taking to deal with the fragile context we operate in are no longer effective. Data clearly showed that the Euphrates River, on which more than 12 million people in both Syria and Iraq depend, has 70% less water than usual. And other data from NASA Earth System Observatory showed that this regional drought across the region is likely to be the worst in 900 years.
What are the root causes of this drought?
It is multi-layered, allow me to say. The water crisis is hitting the countries that already are experiencing one of the worst humanitarian crises of our times. 10 years into conflict in Syria, for example, with the economic crisis and COVID-19, meant that more than ever are in need of humanitarian assistance. However, just looking closely at the causes of the current water crises, we are seeing that Syria and Iraq are experiencing the worst drought level in 70 years. There is a record low levels of rainfall and temperatures keeping rising. The Euphrates River, in which more than 12 million people in Syria and Iraq depend, has 70% less water than usual. Most of the water stations are not working anymore, some due to the low water levels in dams that provide electricity to the region, and others due to the destruction by conflict and resulting lack of maintenance and repair. Adding to that, the internally displaced communities who already struggle to survive day by day are worse hit. Many of them live in camps or informal settlements that are rarely connected to the water systems. They are dependent on water trucking from the humanitarian organizations. And even that, they are not having, constant access to it. To be very honest, the situation is made worse. But the fact is, we have not seen the worst days yet.
Okay. Talk to me about what actions and steps need to be implemented immediately.
The water crisis is affecting the electricity. And this is something that we need to factor in. For example, in northern Syria, two dams will likely close soon, and then 3 million people will be without electricity. And this is affecting families in their homes, but also public services such as hospitals and health centers. Many essential facilities can only operate with generators today, and often only for 1 or 2 hours per day. Imagine a hospital treating wounded people, and COVID-19 patients or mothers giving birth have to work without electricity. In the same time, we're already seeing outbreaks of diarrhea as people simply don't have access to clean water. And in displaced camps, for internally displaced people, over 90% of the population say that they have to rely on water trucking and they cannot afford paying for enough water, especially now during the hot summer temperatures. What happens is that people have to prioritize using water to drink for themselves or their children, and often having not enough water for hand washing. This is posing, of course, a huge risk where hardly anyone is vaccinated against COVID-19. From an action perspective, there are so many things that need to be done, but the top priority, because there is no time to waste, authorities in the region and donor governments across the world need to act now to save these lives. And I think that the big priority here is the funding, especially that humanitarian funding has been cut drastically in the past year, especially for the northeast of Syria. And more support is needed to sustain humanitarian operations. So we have more needs, but less resources than ever today.
Certainly, war and regional conflict are made so much worse by a climate crisis like this. But in a kind of vicious cycle, this kind of climate crisis can also then lead to greater international tensions within the region. Can you talk to us a little bit about the way that regional governments, maybe particularly those that are somewhat wealthier, nations like Turkey, are in relationship with nations, for example, like Syria, in this moment?
I mean, the situation is impacting everyone. I mean, there are no exceptions here. I mean, this year, the droughts are not just hitting Syria and Iraq harder than usual. We can also see that people in Turkey's major cities are suffering from water shortages as water reservoirs have been depleted since last year. This is the regional crisis that requires everyone to act together to try to find a solution. The latest fires in Turkey are unfortunately showing how drastic the impact of the drought is, not just again on specific country, but across the region.
Is there something that listeners can do, that individuals can do in this moment?
Sure. I mean, I think that the support has to be, on multi-levels. We are very grateful for donor governments that support care and the humanitarian community to serve the communities that are mostly in need. But there is also the fact that active citizenship, an example in the US, can play a more active role to really engage on advocacy, on support, advocacy to your local representatives and making sure that these issues are raised to their attention. And there is also the importance of participating and hopefully, donating if possible to similar causes that are not necessarily always on the forefront of the humanitarian agenda in some areas of the world. So it's important to raise this level of attention towards it.
Nirvana Shaki is the Middle East and North Africa Regional Director for CARE. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you, Melissa.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. The 80s and 90s were full of memorable Black characters on the small screen. Take, for example, Carl Winslow and Steve Urkel of Family Matters.
Now, if you want to do stick out your pelvis, I'm telling you, baby, it's better than anything.
And of course, we also had Will, Uncle Phil, and Aunt Viv on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Honey, the last time we saw you, you were this funny little boy. Now look at you. Oh my goodness, you are a man.
That was the plan.
It is amazing. You certainly have grown, Will.
And how could you not love the ladies of Living Single?
What the hell?
For your information, we are having a beauty night.
It ain't working.
And let's not forget identical twin sisters, Tia and Tamara of Sister Sister.
What are you doing?
We're going home.
Hey, you let go of my baby.
Hey, what do you mean your baby? Hey, what's that now?
What?
Get out of here. What?
These were iconic Black characters in front of the camera, but they masked a very different reality behind the scenes. From the writer's room to the executive suite, Black creators were few and far between. Writer's room diversity has improved in recent decades. Shout out to Shonda Rhimes, but there's still plenty of work to be done. For more on this, we're joined now by Hannah Georges, staff writer for The Atlantic. She recently penned a piece on Black-led television shows and the writers behind them. Hannah, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Kim Bass, creator of Sister Sister, Kenan and Kel, and staff writer on the first two seasons of In Living Color. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hannah, I want to start off by playing a clip that you actually write about at the beginning of your piece. I want to listen to an exchange between Carl Winslow and his son Eddie in a 1994 episode of Family Matters.
I was on my way to a party in Burlington Heights. I was driving along minding my own business when the cops pulled me over.
Did they ask you for your license and registration?
Yeah. Then I asked what the problem was, and one of them told me to shut up. Then he made me get out of the car and lie face down. Then he cuffed me.
That's unusual procedure. Unless you provoked it.
But I didn't. People were driving by looking at me like I was a criminal, and I didn't even do anything.
All right, Hannah. What did you learn about the writing process behind that scene?
Well, I spoke with Felicia D. Henderson, who was a writer in the room at the time. And Felicia told me about the experience of being in that room, hearing that line proposed, and saying essentially that that's not a realistic way for a Black father, even one who's a cop, to speak to his son. And she said that the room of writers felt like she was accusing them of being racist just because she said, hey, maybe this dialogue isn't the way we want to play this out. And that I think she said, you know, you could hear a pin drop because people were sort of so silent and uncomfortable when she said, maybe this isn't the right way to do it.
Kim, let me ask you, before you were creating your own shows, when you were working in writers' rooms where you had less control over the racial diversity of it, is that the kind of experience that that you can relate to, that you experienced?
Absolutely. It was a very interesting experience to be in a room where if the subject happened to be about Black life in America or the characters were Black and had to interact in society, and to have the opinions of a non-Black person who would be in charge of the show sort of override things that didn't seem right for someone like myself and maybe another writer at the time. And we got into huge arguments over such things. But I will say, I did feel free to argue because ultimately the decision was not going to be mine. So I thought it was my job, certainly my obligation, to fight what I believed was right, and so that there wouldn't be some sort of portrayal that, you know, was counter to what I knew to be true.
And Hannah, I'm going to come to you. I want to talk a little bit about class. In the early 90s in particular, there was an interesting dichotomy where on the one hand, often on the big screen, we saw Black characters from working class and poor communities. And on the small screen, there was a lot of focus around middle income and middle class characters. What did you learn about the writers behind those sort of middle class shows?
Right. Well, people got pushback on that, too. I spoke quite a bit with Susan Fales Hill, who was in the room for The Cosby Show and went on to be lead writer and EP on A Different World. And she remembers having an executive tell her that the Cosby family was white, because, you know, they lived in that house and their, you know, their jobs were what they were, right? That this was a family who, because they were upper middle class and occupied a social class that felt more familiar to him through the lens of whiteness, had to be white. So you had those kinds of things happening. But one thing I was curious about as I spoke with people was what sorts of experiences were being left out, because some of the ways of communicating about Black stories have to be done in ways that feel comfortable to white executives, yes, to white showrunners potentially, yes, but in ways that feel very like they operate from a sense of sort of middle class values, and like you have to speak as though you went to a certain kind of school. And when writers are put into that box as well, I think that the shows that we see look different.
Kim, I want to talk to you about what it was like to be in a writer's room where there weren't a lot of African Americans. Did you ever feel that there were going to be negative career repercussions for speaking up about authenticity and Blackness in the scripts?
Absolutely. There were jobs that I didn't get because I spoke up about what they were asking me to write. That happened in certain occasions. There was one particular show that I was offered to be a co-executive producer on the show, and they sent me the pilot script, and there were so many things in it that were so offensive as far as I was concerned regarding Black people. So I had a meeting with the executive producer, and his justification for writing the things that he wrote, he said, well, my roommate in college talked like that. And I said, well, I don't know who your roommate was, but you know, that kind of language, you know, might have been prevalent 25 years ago, but it isn't now, and I find it offensive. And so the position I was offered was withdrawn. And I believe I was brought there to basically put the Black stamp on what they were trying to do with that show. And I would.
Oh, more than a few of us have been that great brown and Black stamp of approval on things that are problematic. I absolutely get that. And yet, Hannah, I want to push on this a little bit and leave room for the possibility that a racial match between the story, the storyteller, and the show creator may not necessarily be required to tell great stories. So, you know, for me, and this is just personal preference, I'm not a fan of Tyler Perry, recognizing that many people are. But boy, I'm a big fan of those Norman Lear shows from the 1970s. So I don't, you know, and again, this is just my personal preferences. Maybe it's because of my age. But I don't want to leave out the possibility, one, that not all Black folks can tell all Black stories well, and also that there might be white folks who could tell Black stories well.
Right. You know, going into this, I was less foreclosed on the possibility that could happen, right? Like, I spoke with Norman Lear and I referenced those shows, and I do think that they did a really interesting, that they accomplished something very real and very important in bringing a viewership in and having Black viewers as well feel not just represented, but excited by TV at the time that they were airing. So I think that's more than possible. What I'm curious about, what I'm always curious about, is sort of the power dynamics at hand. And when less what's possible and more who are making these decisions and why, and what are we losing because of it? What do we not see on our screens because fewer people get opportunities? And sort of less the idea that only Black people can tell stories about Black characters.
I like the way that you frame that, sort of what are we missing here? And so, Kim, I guess I'd want to ask you that. You know, we're in a time now where we're seeing not only an increase in Black writers on shows with Black characters, but we're also seeing intersectional Black characters that we've never seen before. I'm thinking about the ways that new spaces outside of the networks have allowed, you know, stories like Pose and others to come forward. So I'm wondering, when you talk to younger Black writers today, how are they feeling about the power dynamics for creating and bringing forth Black stories of various kinds?
I think that the younger people who are coming out now are seeing it less as Black stories, but sometimes as Black characters in stories. And I believe that's there's a distinction there, and there should be, because the prevalence of the stereotypical thoughts around writing and characters is sort of old school. And what we're talking about now rather than say it's a black story, it might be a story that has black people in it. It might be a show that has black characters in it. And of course, we're not a monolith. The black people are not a monolith. And so you have to be free and you have to be open. So I always say, write what you know, because everyone's experiences are different, and including black people.
So talk to me, Kim, about writing what you know in the context of bringing forth not only that diversity within racialized communities, but also sort of trying to manage that authenticity and both be authentic to what your own experiences might be, but also to hear maybe even beyond sort of exactly what you yourself have experienced.
Well, I'll give you an example. The first part of my life, when I was up until about age 9 or 10, we're in an all-black community in what one would call a ghetto. After that, I was in an all-predominantly white community. As a matter of fact, our family was the only black family in the town. And that, again, was a different experience, but I'm still the same black person. Hmm. And so I have experiences that maybe others didn't have. And, you know, I grew up doing many, many different things. And I try to bring that authenticity to things. And if people talk about, you know, my show, Sister, Sister, well, I grew up with twin sisters. So that gave me an insight. It wasn't about just being black, but I had twin sisters. And Kenan and Kel was based on my experience with my best friend when we were kids. But it's completely different. And if I might, I have a couple of films coming out next year, early next year. And one is about a white family. I wrote and directed that. And the other is an ensemble cast with all these terrific black actors, predominantly Latinos as well. And I dare say that people will find it hard to believe that the same writer director made both those films. But in fact, both of those films were natural fits for me.
I love your point, and I'm so glad you brought us there, that it's not only about a question of sort of the possibilities for non-black writers writing black stories or stories that have black characters, but also, and Hannah, I want to come to you on this, the idea that black showrunners can be creating stories with racially diverse casts, with predominantly white casts. And let's talk about Shonda Rhimes, Hannah.
Oh, of course. I mean, I love the way that Shonda Rhimes talks about her shows and talks about her just reflecting the world as she sees it and not sort of emphasizing this like capital D diversity that informs the way that we talk about TV sometimes. And that feels so true and it feels so real when you look at her shows, that this is a group of people who are interacting with one another in a workplace. And so, of course, they all look different from one another and their lives are complicated and messy in different ways because that's life.
It is wild that she's able to balance in some ways things that feel very realistic, like, you know, a sister taking her braids out or dealing with her natural hair or whatever, but also in scripts where lots of wildly unlikely things happen. And there is that kind of fun balance between those. Hannah Georges is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and Kim Bass is the creator of Sister, Sister, and Kenan and Kel. And as you heard, he's got a few theatrical releases coming out soon as well. So look for those. They're called Head Shop and Tyson's Run, both out in 2022. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's the show, folks. And all that talk about those amazing black TV shows just brought me all the way back. I think I'm going to have to watch A Little Different World before bed tonight.
Go on, Reverend. Go on.
I can't tell she responds.
Well, she means yes.
Well, she's got to say yes.
Whitley, I love you, and if you'll have me, I want you to be my wife. Will you have me, Dwayne, as your lawfully wedded husband from this day forth to having a home and richer for poorer? Please!
I do!
That wedding scene just never gets old. Baby, please! If you missed any of our show today or you want to listen back, check out our podcast. It's available wherever you find your audio. And of course, call us with show ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you again tomorrow.